All right, I want to thank everybody for coming today. And you're here for expanding your local and global audiences, I hope. So can everybody hear me okay in the back? No? Okay. A little better? Okay. We're each going to talk about basically case studies and what we're doing at our various institutions, and then we'll have time for questions at the end. My name is John Ainsley. I'll be speaking last. I've been head of Marist College Archives and Special Collections. Marist is in Poughkeepsie, New York, about an hour and a half from New York City. And I am on the steering committee of the College and University Archives section for SIA. I'm also on the advisory committee for the Northeast Document Conservation Center. I did my graduate work at North Carolina UNC Chapel Hill and at North Carolina State University. And being a glutton for punishment, I'm pursuing my PhD in history at the State University of New York at Albany. Lynn Eaton will be speaking first. She's the reference archivist for the Hartman Center for Sales, Advertising, Marketing History, and the Rare Book, Manuscript, and Special Collections Library at Duke University. Previous to this appointment in 2004, Lynn served as the Hartman Center Technical Services Archivist and a project manager for an NEH grant-funded processing project on outdoor advertising collections. She's also managed three digital projects at Duke, including one funded by an Ameritech grant. She served as the chair of the Reference Access and Outreach section of SAA and is active in SAA as well as the Society of North Carolina Archivists. Tom Sommer will be speaking second and has been the University and Technical Services Archivist in the Special Collections Division of the University Libraries at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, UNLV, since 2006. He's working on several projects, including reorganizing the university archives, creating EAD finding aids, and updating the Special Collections website. He's a board member of the Conference of the Intermountain Archivists and Nevada Key Contact for the Society of American Archivists Membership Committee, and he was recently elected to the UNLV Faculty Senate's Faculty Development Leave Committee. And now I'm going to turn it over to Lynn.
Good morning, and thank you all for coming. As you can see, mine is Time to Dare and Endure, New and Next Steps for Duke Special Collections Research Services Outreach. And I wanted to put into context our Special Collections Library at Duke University. We have the rare books and manuscript divisions together, but then we also have a number of centers. So the center I work in is the Hartman Center for Sales, Advertising, Marketing, History, and then there's also Women's History, African and African American History. We have visual materials, jazz. There are so many, I'm not remembering them all. So that we have the centers in there, and we also have university archives as well. So from that, you can see that there are a lot of different constituents that we are trying to reach when we're doing research services and reaching out to our audiences. So I really credit the leadership of the Special Collections Library for putting this on their agenda for this year. We do goals each year, and for this year, the number one goal was to raise the profile of RBMSCL in the Duke community and among potential users. And RBMSCL is a Rare Book Manuscript Special Collection Library. So if any of y'all would like to have your name inserted here, you can just write a check with the right amount of zeros. And we'll be glad to do that. It'll be simpler for me. And so within this raising the profile, what we've done has been to create a public relations team. Now, we had a public relations team before, but this is a new, energized, and innovative team. And what we're supposed to be doing is just thinking outside the box. And to help us do that, we've expanded the units of people involved. And so we have the communications director for the library is on the public relations team. And we have the exhibits person for the entire library is also on the team. So they're bringing a different perspective. And when we're talking about how do we make ourselves more visible to the communities that we want ourselves to be visible to. And so what we do is we meet every couple weeks and we throw ideas up on the wall to see if they stick. And then we throw them up again to see if they stick a little bit later. So it's this, let's try new things and let's go beyond what we've done before. And one of the things that we're doing, one of our initiatives, is to send out press releases of different events or exhibits that we've been doing. And that has really helped us because The communications director sends it to the Duke News and Communications Services, and they send it out. And sometimes people don't pick up what we're doing, but sometimes they do. And so we are able to have news events out in newspapers or magazines, and then we also get phone calls from different media outlets who want information about what we're doing. And we were lucky, I don't know if y'all have read the USA Today this morning, but with Mad Men coming out, the director of the Hartman Center was interviewed, and she was quoted in that article. And so that's one of those things of our getting the message out has helped people come in and then thus get the message out even further. We're also going to conduct usability studies of our finding aids and our other websites to revise them and make them more accessible and usable to our constituents. So this is our lovely finding aids first page. And we originally had our finding aids in DynaWeb. I don't know if any of y'all remember that. And then we moved them to the CMS of Duke University. Now, the issue that we had there was that we're not the ones who moved it into the CMS. The systems group moved it into the CMS. And unfortunately, they did not contact us very much when they moved it in. And their viewpoint was undergraduate users. So undergraduate users don't do a lot of advanced searching, so all they want to do is throw in a term and they'll find it, and it was a different kind of viewpoint of who we usually talk to. I mean, 50% of our constituents are undergraduate and graduate students at Duke University, but then 50% of our other constituents are beyond, worldwide, national, so they're going to have a different perspective. So now what we're doing is that we're working in conjunction with that systems group to help them understand what our users are looking for and to help us find out more of what our users are looking for in terms of finding the information in our finding aids. This also applies to our digital collections. And the digital collections, y'all have digital collections too, and I'm sure you found out with digital collections, people who have never really thought about special collections see what's in your repository, and then they get excited and they contact you. And we have things like music, and then we have advertising, Duke University history, and so people contact us because they've seen something, right? They're searching for sheet music, and all of a sudden they see it, and they had no idea what was there. And so it makes them excited about special collections, and it's not even the special collections just at our university, but whatever their local area is. It's like, oh, so that's what is in your holdings. And then we're also going to be doing revising the home page for the library and the different centers to bring a branding aspect to it, but also individual branding as well. So what are we doing beyond that? We've put up images on Flickr. And so the Duke University Archives was one of the first groups to put images up on Flickr. And to be honest, they put it up on Flickr because the digital collections have a specific structure in which to work. So you have to have this amount of metadata, and you have to have this kind of framework for it. But Flickr allows you to put up whatever you want to do. And so the great thing about where we are now at Duke is everything is kind of dynamic, and we're testing the waters, so people can do not anything they want to do, but almost anything that they want to do. So Flickr was what the archives did. And they let us know. I talked to the archivist, and he said that even though the use is from alumni, they used to talk to him to get images, and now they can just go to the web page. But what he's found is that people contact him for more information about what they want to see, more information about what's in the university archives or just overall what's going on at Duke. The Women's Center also puts up images on Flickr. They have a different sort of view. They put up more images of events that have gone on as opposed to images strictly from their collection, which is what the university archives have done. Then we also have things up on YouTube, and y'all have things on YouTube too. And what we found is that it really brings in a different user group because people are seeing this and it's a more active visual experience of what you have. Print ads are fine or pictures of what's going on, but if you can have people talking or your images up there with music and an over voice, that's great. And so people who wouldn't, find your material any other way are doing searches and your video pops up and they're going to pull it. So one of the things that we've done, we have a new Jazz Archives that just opened last year, basically. And so they put up this YouTube video to let people know about the big band and jazz tradition at Duke University, about the jazz archives, to hopefully get the word out that there's a jazz archives, but hopefully also to get people to contact us to say, oh, I've got this information about jazz, or oh, I didn't know about that. So we're trying to have more of a conversation with people by putting our message out in different ways. We also put up exhibits. We've been really lucky, the Duke News and Communication Services, if they hear about something that we're doing and they think it will have wide appeal, then they will come over and they'll do an interview with us and make a video for us. And then they'll put it up on YouTube and then we can link to it. And this exhibit was A Century of Sex Appeals. Yes, sex sells. So people were very interested in that. We've gotten 2,800 views of this exhibit on YouTube. Now, whether people actually stayed and looked at it, I don't know. If they see it was sex and then it's in a library, it's like, oh, maybe not. But hopefully they did. And what we've been able to do is then use this as not necessarily a bully pulpit, but a way to get our message out. So this is the director of the Hartman Center, and she was interviewed and shown with the exhibit behind her and talking about the pieces in the exhibit. And these are some of the lascivious women that James B. Duke's father called lascivious women that James B. Duke put in. They're little trade cards that go in the cigarette packs. And so he had the bright idea of if you're going to have something to firm up the cigarette packs, put something on there that people want to see. There you go. We also have events that we chronicle through the videos and then put them up. So the Women's Center, we're celebrating their 20th anniversary, and so they had interviews with the different people involved in the Bingham Center over the course of its lifetime. And that's been very popular. We also had a Reality of Mad Men event, and that was looked at as well. But beyond that, we also have information for people that might just be interesting information. So this is our broadsides collection, and so the conservation officer was talking about what they were doing, what they had done in the past to conserve broadsides, and what they're doing in the future to conserve broadsides. One of the things we also did was for the election and the inauguration, we were talking about how can we take advantage of this event. And so what we did is the preservation officer did a video on how do you preserve the newspapers and magazines that you've bought during the inauguration for Obama and keep them. And that's been very popular. That has had over 2,000 hits. So that was a service to the community, but it also let them know what we were and what we were able to do. And then our next foray has been into iTunes. This is a new project that we have. I really wanted to show you a commercial, but it wouldn't work here. But these are digitized historic commercials, and so you're getting, again, a different audience because these are people who want to see something more interactive and interesting than just plain print ads, and they're kind of funny. I would suggest taking a look. This is the iTunes website or viewing point, and we have gotten, in the past 2 weeks, it just went up in July, but in the past 2 weeks, we've gotten 70,000 hits on our website. But this iTunes homepage has gotten 625,000 hits in the past 2 weeks. So we are getting huge amounts of traffic on something that, I mean, it's really fortunate for us that we've had people help pay for this because we couldn't have done this on our own. But it's a different kind of format and it's a different kind of, information that's being put out there. And so people are really enjoying it. And because of this, we've gotten calls from ad agencies who have commercials who haven't really heard of us yet. And so now they're interested in giving their materials to us. So it's making the most out of what we are able to do. And these are just some clips from the commercials. I myself like the Fruit Stripe five-flavor gum. That's my favorite one so far, but we'll see how that goes. And the other thing that we've done that's not related to technology is that we had an instruction retreat with the general reference librarians. And how it works at Duke is that the reference librarians are contacted by the professors, or they contact the Writing 20 professors, and they create presentations about how do you search for the library. And what we wanted to do was to talk to them and let them know more about special collections. So we had an open house, laid out a bunch of the stuff that we have, and talked to them and introduced them to all the materials that we have and how possibly they could use that for classes. And so our hope is that this semester there will be much more use of special collections material for the classes. And it's already helped me. I've been in contact with one of the reference librarians, and we're set to do a class together this fall. So that's been a good help there. So what are our next steps? Blog. I know many of y'all probably already have blogs. We've been holding back, trying to see where we want to go. It's going to be called The Devil's Tale Dispatches from the Rare Book Manuscript Special Collections Library. And basically, we want to hit our current user group, but we hopefully want to expand that user group. But at the least, we want to increase our branding, build the brand in just a different way, and have more information out about it. We want to do more flip camera interviews. Flip cameras are pretty simple to use, and you can download them and put them up relatively easily. So what we want to do is to use that as a venue to say, here is a way to experience special collections, kind of have people go behind the scenes, right? So one of the ideas we were going to have is to do a collection from intake into putting it on the shelves and ready for reference so that people can see what it takes to, for even for their own collections, but what we do. We'll also want to interview people who are in research services. So what is it that you do? People who are in collection development. And what I think is going to be really interesting are the people in technical services, because that's really behind the wall. Nobody sees what's going on there, and they have no idea. So that's going to be something, hopefully, that'll be interesting to people as well. And then Twitter, the Franklin Center is doing a Twitter area on their homepage. The Hartman Center hasn't done it, and no one else really in Special Collections has done it, so we're kind of interested to see what happens and how much traffic Karen Jean gets from this and where it goes and where it helps her go from there. Again, this is another example of how not everybody has to do the same thing to get the word out. And then we're just going to continue with the goals from leadership. What for us, we want to shift the way that we're doing digitization requests, so we get all these reference requests, and they want copies of, you know, ads or copies of documents, whatever. And so what we're trying to do is to shift it into a different model to have it done quicker. And so hopefully maybe even get professor requests if they are requesting different documents to have all of those up online. We are going to explore and recommend improved discovery options for our collection metadata, including the catalog. So we want to see how people are searching the catalog and possibly do something different to help them find the information that will help them use our collections. And then, the most basic, is to renovate the reading room. We're going through a big renovation, hopefully, if the economy gets better. We are going to renovate our reading room area. And so what we're planning to do is to make that reading room more user-friendly, more open to people, more accessible, so that people will be interested to come in. I know when I was an undergraduate, I never went in the special collections room because it was too scary to go into. So what we're trying to do is to break down that wall and have people come in and hopefully use our material that way. And that's what we're doing at Duke, and thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. Now I'm going to turn the talk over to Tom.
Good morning. Did everybody have their coffee this morning? Yes, good. Starbucks, I hope. I own stock in the company. Keep buying. No, I'm just kidding. welcome to our event this morning. I'm in particular going to talk about UNLV Special Collections and how we're expanding our reach and use. As we all know, archiving websites have come a long way in the last 15 years. HTML was a standard by which we lived for a very long time. It's a standard that served us well, and now it's become static. Companies began to realize out there that end users wanted to add a little more to the website. They wanted to get involved. Now, this need for interactivity grew more and more in the last several years. The end user was now able to add not only information, but make it more accessible, make it more, they say added value is the term that gets thrown out there all the time, not only on the corporate side, but also on the academic side. So interactivity has become the name of the game right now in the academic world. The following are examples of how archives around the world have responded to these Web 2.0 ideas and initiatives. Now, an institution that utilizes Web 2.0 services is like Temple University's Urban Archives. They have an Ask a Librarian service that allows students and librarians to communicate easily via instant messaging. There are other Web 2.0 ideas like tagging or folksonomy or comments, and this engages the researcher by allowing them to add their own knowledge on a subject. One archiving site that has utilized this idea is the Hogs Gemeenteschap Hague City Archives in the Netherlands. Now, this site allows the user to enter their own descriptions to photographs a la Flickr. The goal is to provide as much detailed information as possible for the next user of the photograph. There were even instances where users corrected the official descriptions. Now, another Web 2.0 feature is the recommender systems. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but there's the Polar Bear Expedition Digital Collection, which is a site that features a more implicit recommender system. It's kind of interesting because you probably have seen it on websites like Amazon.com. Now, specifically, it uses links paths. And what that is you can find them at the bottom of every page of this website, and it functions as a type of automatic recommender system, and the system relays immediate feedback to researchers on how other visitors reach a particular item or collection. Now, the link paths may be another avenue for researchers to locate information via alternate interrelations between subjects and collections. Now, it's similar to the feature found on Amazon.com, where it says researchers who viewed this page also viewed. So you might actually start seeing recommender systems on archiving websites soon. This retracing of steps is growing more and more on the Web 2.0 side of the world. Now, another Web 2.0 idea within the archiving field is the mashup. It's the idea of combining two databases to make one source of information. And you can see this being used within the Biodiversity Heritage Library website. The site uses a Google Maps feature, and it's a catalog that helps patrons access its online records in an expedient manner. Now, UNLV Special Collections has been actively working towards creating an archival space in the 21st century that assists its patrons in its quest for historical discovery. Now, this discovery has helped patrons ranging from researchers to students. And UNLV Special Collections has created a space that has incorporated several different points of access that include virtual exhibits, search boxes, and digital collections. Now, our Special Collections has even added Web 2.0 features to aid in the discovery of historical material. And these 2.0 features have ranged from a What's New blog to digital collections with interactivity features. Now, one point of access that I wanted to talk about today, of course, is the virtual exhibit. Now, these virtual exhibits were created as a static HTML page that showcase unique materials housed within our collections. They show the scope and diversity of materials available to researchers, faculties, and students. A good example of this is Dean at the Sands. We all know this guy. This virtual exhibit is a point of discovery for the history of not only Dean Martin, though, but of the Rat Pack. The photographs in this exhibit come from the Sands Collection. The Sands Collection was basically the name of a hotel and resort that is no longer there on the Strip, but it's very famous, and it's a very large collection within UNLV Special Collections. Now, this page, it's a static HTML page, and it provides information and pictures regarding one of Las Vegas' most famous entertainers. But it also has links to not only the Rat Pack information, but to other resources like to books and videotapes on the subject. This virtual exhibit contains a wide range of photographs, as you can see, of Dean Martin. There you see him hamming it up there at the Sands, at the Copa Room. Now, I'd like to point out another access point within the UNLV Special Collections, and that's the search box. Now, this is brand new to us. We wanted to kind of have a one-stop shop for researchers. Now, it's located on the home page, as you can see, and it searches the inventories to our manuscripts, photographic, and oral history collections. The purpose of its creation was to expedite the discovery of material within our collections. Now, for example, a researcher would not have to go drilling down a long page looking for exactly the collection they were looking for. Instead, we decided, you know what, they can go to one space, it's a one-stop shop, and the index that comes back shows a researcher not only a list, but highlights the key word on that list, so they know they're getting exactly what they're looking for. Another point of access that we have on the UNLV Special Collections website is, of course, the digital collection. And you can see several of them there. We have Southern Nevada, the Boomtown Years, Showgirls, Las Vegas, and Water in the West, Howard Hughes, and Dino at the Sands. Now, basically, as we all know, digital collections are, you know, the digital copies of the original materials, whether they be maps or manuscripts or whatnot. Now, these digital copies are presented online and organized in an easily searchable way. And we use Content DM databases in order to provide this to our researchers. And it offers full-text searches, browsing, zoom, pan, side-by-side comparison, and exporting of digital objects for presentation and reuse. Here's the homepage to our Las Vegas and Water in the West digital collection. Here's our Southern Nevada and Las Vegas and maps. Here's our Showgirls digital collection. Now, UNLV Special Collections has continually strived to stay on top of the latest in innovations within the web. So what we've decided to do is not only keep track of these ideas and trends and discovery, but we decided to go one step further. We want to make the blogs. You know, we don't want to refer people to other resources. We want them to stay right where they're at. So we decided to go create blogs, wikis. We added Web 2.0 features to our digital collections. We really wanted to be ahead of the curve. Now, the nice thing about what we've been doing is, in the last year, we've created this blog. It's our example of it, and it's called our What's New page. And it basically allows staff to post news items and allows patrons to add comments of their own. And it has an RSS feature. Now, this blog was one of the first steps from our special collections to add Web 2.0 features on our website. Now, UNLV Special Collections has created even a staff wiki page for internal use for library staff. It mirrors our original website, and it allows wiki capabilities, which will allow staff to add their own information to our own staff wiki site. Now, as stated earlier, one of the points of access on our website is the digital collection. However, the latest digital collections include Web 2.0 features. Now, before we look at some of these Web 2.0 features, let's take a look at the steps that our digital collections go through in order to be created. Well, first of all, we have a team downstairs called the Web and Digitization Services Division. And they come up with the ideas of what kind of different projects we want to do with the Content TM databases that they create. And they meet with our Director of Special Collections, and they sit down and they go over some of the topics. And now there's even a group that not goes beyond Special Collections, but also meets with people throughout the library and throughout the campus. But Special Collections is definitely the heart of our digital collections, because they come to us for content. And then once we give them some content, they scan the items, whether it be photographs or documents and maps. Then WDS creates the metadata, and then they design the website. And this is all fed through a Content TM database. So we're very fortunate. We have a great team that's working together to provide the latest and greatest. Now, UNLV Special Collection has gone that extra step now to add features like comments, rate it feature, and an RSS feature. Now, these latest Web 2.0 additions continue to aid in our patrons' discovery of historical material. It allows interactivity on our Special Collections website. We all know this gentleman, Mr. Howard Hughes. And this is an example of a digital collection with a comments feature. We also have a rated feature within this digital collection. And kind of like Lynn was mentioning, about how we're trying all these different ideas. Now, a year from now, we may not be using some of these features. And that's kind of, well, the kind of the excitement of Web 2.0. You know, will Twitter be around in a couple years? We don't know. But we're willing to try it. If that's what our end user is trying to get to our information, we're going to try it out. So, we've even added RSS features within our digital collections, so people can stay up to date with any updates within those digital collections. Now, our latest digital collection is the Southern Nevada Boomtown Years. Now, this particular digital collection brings together a wide range of original materials from various collections located within UNLV Special Collections, the Nevada State Museum, and Historical Society in Las Vegas, and also the Clark County Heritage Museum. This digital collection even provides standards-based activities for elementary and high school students. This is the latest digital collection from UNLV Libraries and provides a wide range of useful discovery features like recent comments, tags, and Google Maps to various Southern Nevada boom towns. Here's the recent comments section right there. They constantly get posted as soon as someone adds their comment. Here's our tagging feature. As you guys have all heard, tagging clouds. We decided to not only use it in the UNLV Libraries main catalog, but we're adding them to our digital collections. So as you can see, it's becoming more and more popular, and the bigger the word is, the more our end user has been using the keyword. So we are really staying on top of what our end users are looking for within even our digital collections. Finally, we have a Google Maps feature. And it was included in the Boomtown years because we've been seeing it more and more. And we have, like I said, a great team downstairs that goes out, checks the web like we do, and we work together as a team and say, okay, you know what? If we're starting to see this Google Maps feature more and more, let's do it. If that's what they're using, let's try it out. And I think it really will take off because it really is an easy interface for people to click on one of the cities that you'll see on the map. A little index will come up, and you can click on a link that'll take you maybe to an online catalog record of, say, a book on that particular city, that particular boom town. And, of course, what's Web 2.0 without Facebook? We decided to implement this. Our manuscripts librarian, Su Kim Chung, worked with another staff member to provide this particular avenue of discovery just in the last 6 months. Now, you can not only post comments, but you can access information on the various resources located within our collections. Now, in conclusion, the UNLV Special Collections has planned and implemented several online tools that allow patrons access to extensive resources within our archives. Now, these tools, of course, range from virtual exhibits to a staff wiki to digital collections with Web 2.0 features. And UNLV's Special Collections wants to continue to strive to stay on top of these trends as we continue into the 21st century. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Now I'm going to talk about our Lowell Thomas collection and the Lowell Thomas travelogues and using online exhibits and digital surrogates to expand your patron base. Marist College was established in 1929, so it's been around for a while, and they've been collecting special collections and acquiring rare book collections during that time. But it wasn't until 2000 when I was hired as their first full-time head of archives and special collections that they've really had an active program. So I've been very fortunate to be able to establish that program and see it grow. When I first started, I was the only full-time employee. I had a couple student assistants to help me out, and now I have a full-time assistant, and I currently have a full-time project archivist, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. And I typically have 4 to 8 students working for me part-time, and a couple students working full-time over breaks, winter and summer breaks. When I first arrived, basically nothing had been done with the collections. I was fortunate that there's a new facility, a new library on the Marist College campus, which has a student body of about 4,000 undergraduates and focuses primarily on liberal arts. The new library had a special collections department, so a small area for special collections, which is great. But the collections were basically in one big mass. So my first goal was to start getting all that straightened out. Once I had some control over the collections, of course, I wanted to start promoting what we had to the outside world, let researchers know about what was held at Marist College. So I did some of the usual things, such as launching a website for the Special Collections, which I did in 2001. I would take advantage of the campus publications, which was a great way for me to get to know the students better and let them know what was going on campus in the Special Collections. used listservs, archives list, and HNET, or the humanities network. And I also work closely with our advancement office to put out press releases. And all of that was very helpful in raising awareness of our special collections. I also found that working as closely as possible with faculty members in appropriate subject areas was more effective for me. They would allow me to target audiences very specifically, and I think a good example of this is the Lowell Thomas collection. One of our foreign language professors is also a T.E. Lawrence scholar, and Thomas was involved with T.E. Lawrence in the early part of his career. She introduced me to people in the T.E. Lawrence Society. She's also been helping to promote the collection at conferences nationally and internationally. And it's been a great relationship, getting to know the folks in the T.E. Lawrence Society. They've used the collection to publish articles in their journal. And it's a small group, but it's a very active group, and they have an active web presence as well. And this has also helped me determine different meta tags to use while encoding to try to make our materials more searchable online. Now, I want to give you a brief overview of some of the online exhibits we've been using. And some of this looks a little bit different since I had to load this on the computer, so I'm just looking at it locally. So if there's some odd things, it's just because of that. So the first slide I'll show you is hidden in plain sight. We have a nice collection of forage paintings at Marist. We have 58 that were donated to us by a single donor. It's a large collection for a college or university and is truly the highlight of our rare book collection. We have a relatively small rare book collection. We wanted to try to offer a really in-depth look at the rare books. So this is an online article that was also published with the Hudson River Valley Review Journal. So they're just before the publication went out, we launched this website, so we're able to have a few additional features on this, including this little video that shows how a forage painting is revealed. So I'll skip to the good part here. So in case somebody isn't aware of what a forage painting actually is, they get to see it. It's hard to actually describe it. There are pictures in the article, which is nice, but this allows them to actually see what it is and how it really works. Interestingly, I think, is that the bibliography receives the most hits on this site. It was a lot of fun doing the research for this and writing the article, and I wanted to give as comprehensive a bibliography as I could, because while doing it, I realized there's not a lot of sources out there, and people seem to appreciate this. It's put me in contact with Martin Frost, who is one of the foremost forage painters around today. He's over in England, and he lectures extensively on it. So hopefully we'll be able to arrange to have him come to Marist to give a talk, too. So it was a nice outcome to be, because of the website, he contacted me and was very excited to see this exhibit online. So it's been a nice back and forth. So back out of here. Next, I'm going to show you the Marist Environmental History Project. This is an ongoing project for Marist. And the main goal is to show who has what around the country concerning the Scenic Hudson decision, also known as the Storm King case. And this was an environmental law case that started in the early 1960s. Consolidated Edison wanted to put a power plant on the Hudson River near Cornwall, New York. And this group, Scenic Hudson, formed to fight this power plant. So it ended up being a 17-year-long court case that helped set national precedent and started the Environmental Protection Agency. And ultimately, in 1983, Scenic Hudson won the case, and they've become basically the dominant environmental group in New York State and are very active across the country. But we include our list of primary sources here, since Marist funded this, we decided we could go first and be the stars of the site here. And it also shows that most of it's on the materials are on the East Coast, but Denver Public Library has some important materials as well. And a nice outcome of this was that it was recognized by the New York State Archives, and we received an award for excellence in documenting New York State history. So obviously my director was really happy and the college was happy, so I was pleased to get some recognition by another agency for our work. Recently, we've been doing oral histories with people that were involved in the Storm King case or that were affected by the Storm King case. And using these interviews and some of our archival footage,
how do you feel
we created an audio documentary.
Plant was defaced the area.
Well, in spite of everything which they say, the construction of this plant would be a hideous eyesore on the mountainside.
Nearly 10 million people
at the beginning
need more electricity.
It's planned for 800.
Our Cornwall project will provide it at lower cost and with greater reliability than by any other means. We in Con Edison have made every effort to design this plant to fit into its surroundings to be as inconspicuous as possible.
A group of people met in Carl Kammerer's octagon living room in 1963, and she didn't know.
And
so that's just a little bit of the intro. It's the documentary runs about 24 minutes, and I'm currently working with a regional NPR station to try to get this on the air. Scenic Hudson's and the launch or start of the modern environmental movement is coming up on a anniversary, so I'm hoping to be able to get this on the air next year and raise awareness to collections, environmental history collections in the area, and to try to get people to donate more of their materials to colleges or universities or appropriate repositories, not necessarily Marist, but just to make sure that these materials have a good home. Since it's such recent history, I've found in going out and trying to solicit papers, they don't realize that, you know, this really is significant history and it needs to be saved, and it could just, you know, easily get thrown out after somebody passes away. I'm sure everybody's had that experience where you show up and they say, boy, you're interested in that, it's too bad you weren't here yesterday before we threw out all of granddad's papers in the dumpster. So that's another goal of this, and so we have a little about, and we're trying to encourage people to give some more materials to wherever is appropriate again. So another site I'll show you quickly is the Intercollegiate Rowing Association and the Poughkeepsie Regatta. This was a race on the Hudson River. Crew teams from around the country had come to compete on the Hudson. It was considered the elite race in the country. Over 100,000 people would come in every year to see it. So it was quite the event for Poughkeepsie. The reason we did this was because we're coming up, or we're celebrating in the Hudson Valley, the Hudson-Fulton-Champlain Quadricentennial, which celebrates historic voyages on the Hudson River. So there was a huge celebration in 1909, and obviously this doesn't relate directly to it, but everybody in the Hudson Valley is trying to take advantage of this. And if you have something relating to the river, people have been trying to put it up online. So we wanted to do the same, and it's been very successful. We've gotten a lot of great response. It's gotten a lot of press in local newspapers, and a lot of groups have been asking for photographs from this site. And a lot of this, it's not a huge collection, so we're able to put quite a bit of it online, and we tried to make it as interactive as possible with this timeline. So we pulled out some information for people, like who won the races, and we also put up the programs as PDFs, which people really enjoy. We were surprised at how many hits these are getting. So you can see some great visuals, some useful information. A lot of people are finding that their relatives' names and pictures. And there are some fun pictures in there as well. And this also coincides with the restoration of the Cornell Boathouse on the Hudson River, which Marist, even though it's Cornell, was Cornell's, Marist owns that boathouse now. We also, this was became much more time-consuming than we ever anticipated, but we indexed the New York Times for articles relating to the Poughkeepsie Regatta, which was, it was really the paper of record, and discovered that there was well over 1,000 articles out there on it. I can't remember if it broke the 2,000 mark or not. But it proved to be a really useful way to take a look at that history, and has resulted in somebody contacting us who wants to write an article about it and, you know, start to take advantage of some of this stuff. Okay. All right, and the star of the show is the Lowell Thomas travelogues. The Lowell Thomas collection has an interesting history at Marist College. It's actually been there for over 20 years, but it wasn't until 2006 that Marist had the collection officially signed over to the college with all rights and interest in the collection turned over at that time. Just a brief background on Lowell Thomas. He was a household name during the golden age of radio. He was a newsman, an explorer, and entrepreneur. As a newsman, he was on the air on radio primarily for over 46 years. On CBS and NBC, and then NPR as he ended his career. He also did some important work with television and movies, too. And as an entrepreneur, he started Cinerama, which is kind of the granddaddy of IMAX. And when Cinerama was released on Broadway in the early 1950s, it broke all known records in the box office. But Thomas was a smart businessman, and once he saw it was on the decline, he actually got out of the business before his partners. And so he walked away with money, and unfortunately for his partners, they did not. He also started Capital Cities, which was a broadcasting company, which was ultimately purchased by ABC and then by Disney. So he was a very successful businessman as well, and he perhaps is best remembered for his explorations. He traveled the world and told these stories through radio and through television, through movies, and through lectures. The lectures, his first lectures, were called travelogues, or really a multimedia extravaganza. He did many of these travelogues. His best-known one was with Allenby in Palestine and Lawrence in Arabia. During World War I, he was a news correspondent, and he ultimately turned all the information he gathered into these talks. And he was planning to give a six-month tour, which started in the U.S. He quickly went over to England. And he almost spent 6 years giving this talk, traveling the world. This launched him launched his career, and he also is the guy that's really responsible for making T. Lawrence famous as Lawrence of Arabia. So this site is really a teaser to let people know that Marist has the Lowell Thomas collection, and to tell a little bit about what's in the collection, because it's about 1,000 cubic feet of film and audio and photographs and manuscript materials and objects. So it's a massive collection for us. It's far and away the largest collection we have. And after the collection was officially donated to the college, we were able to apply for grant money. So we were very fortunate to receive a grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission. And NHPRC has been marvelous to work with. They've been very supportive. This allowed us to hire a full-time project archivist for 2 years. So can you just imagine, you know, this... It was a huge boost for us, just having such a small staff. And the project is nearing its completion. So in October, this collection will be available to all interested researchers for the first time. And so a lot of this has been tucked away at Marist for you know, a couple of decades. And I think that's caused Thomas's name to fade a bit. So this is a little boost to try to remind people of who he was as his fans are passing away and researchers are getting more interested in him. This shows materials that went into making a travelogue. So we include documents including the original script. So the travelogues, Thomas would have lantern slides. He would have motion picture film clips. He had a live orchestra. He would narrate it live. And on some occasions, he would have dancing girls, including at one point his wife, who filled in. This was, as he termed it, was, purely entertainment. He didn't have any, guys that this was, straight history. So it had an interesting impact on various people as Westerners were introduced to Eastern cultures. So there's a PDF of some correspondence between T. Lawrence and Thomas. Couple of his diaries, which chronicle his exploits in the Middle East. And we also have photos and film clips, which unfortunately didn't transfer well for this part of it, which all make up the mini travelogue that we made. His originals were about 2 hours long. Ours is about 6 minutes. We figured that's probably longer than we'd be able to keep anybody's attention online, realistically. But we also wanted to let people know some of the detail about it. So there's an original paper on here to let people know. It's article-length paper to describe exactly what one of these travelogues and how they came about. In a timeline, which interestingly is been getting a lot of hits. So that's been something I was a little surprised about, but pleasantly surprised. So I'll show you just a little bit of the travelogue that we did.
The Lowell Thomas Travelogues, with Allenby in Palestine and Lawrence in Arabia. Although America played no part in the last and greatest crusade in the Holy Land, the only record of the deeds of the Australians, New Zealanders, Irish, Scotch, English, French, and others who drove the Turks from Jerusalem was obtained by an American mission sent out by the President of the United States. This is not in any sense an historical account of the liberation of the Holy Land and the war in the land of the Arabian Nights. For if I were to tell you of nothing but the achievements of the 10th Irish Division, it would take many hours. And it is merely my privilege to accompany you tonight on a short trip to Palestine and Arabia. I would like to have you close your eyes for a moment and try and forget that you are here in this theater and come with me on a magic carpet out to the land of history, mystery, and romance. One day in Jerusalem, we were walking down Christian Street when a group of Arabs passed us going in the direction of the Damascus Gate. We noticed that one of them was a beardless blonde. Well, in Arabia, there are no fair-haired people, and unless you have a beard, you are not full-grown. And this young fellow was dressed in the robes of an Oriental potentate and wearing the gold sword of a prince of Mecca. Our curiosity was so aroused that an hour later we called at the palace of the British military governor of Jerusalem and asked him who this fair-haired Arab could have been. He ushered us into an adjoining chamber, and there, seated on a Turkish divan, with his feet disrespectfully planted on top of the desk which the German commander-in-chief, von Falkenhayn, had used in working out his plans for trying to keep Allenby out of Palestine, reading a book on archaeology, was the Arab we had passed on Christian Street. General Storrs, in introducing him, said, "I want you to meet Colonel Thomas Lawrence, the uncrowned king of Arabia."
So this has been a successful project for us. It's been a lot of fun for us as well. And it's brought in a range of interesting researchers. Let's see. Our project is wrapping up on October 31st. And so we'll have a full EAD version of our Finding Aid online. And at this point, the Finding Aid's over 2,200 pages long, so we're doing, as you guess, a very detailed inventory. So it's been a challenging trying to design the Finding Aid so it's not too unwieldy. So we actually installed a search engine, so you can search across the entire finding aid from any page, and that hopefully will help people and what they're trying to locate. So at this point, I'm going to jump back to PowerPoint, and I just have a few slides left to show. I wanted to mention Google Analytics. I've found this to be a really useful tool. We've been using it for the past couple years. We used AlterWind in the past, which was fine, but this is Google Analytics has proven to be more convenient for us. It's free. You can view it wherever you have internet access, and we all have a shared account, so we can see what's going on across our libraries. Web usage. This is a chart showing our in-house statistics. By filled research requests, I mean that we supplied a researcher with something from one of our collections to satisfy his or her question. So you can see the light bars represent before we had online finding aids, and this shows number of requests after online finding aids went on the web. Visits to the Marist College Archives and Special Collections website is shown here. This is a monthly average. Again, this shows before and then after online exhibits were used. Sometimes bringing in that many more people may cause you more work than you want some months. But a good thing overall to be busy. This shows websites or web visits from countries, territories outside the U.S. Again, before online exhibits and then after. And ultimately, these charts are not definitive, but I do think that they show that our online exhibits have had a positive impact on our collection usage. And I'm also very pleased to see the growth in our use, considering how young the Marist College Archives and Special Collections is. So in conclusion, who's looking at our stuff? We've had an interesting range of people, playwrights, artists, film producers, museum curators, university professors and students. And after the online exhibits went up, I did notice more unusual questions or requests coming in. We had a young playwright from England who used a lot of lantern slides in his play based in World War I, and T. Lawrence was one of the characters, and he used them as backgrounds throughout his play, which I thought was a really fun use. Sadly, I didn't get a plane ticket over there to see it, but it sounded like it was a lot of fun. We also, and I think this is nice because it shows the collection, is on Thomas. He was such a established character in American popular culture that the fact that Lucasfilms used hundreds of images from the collections was appropriate. Lucas released a DVD box set of the Young Indiana Jones television series from the 90s, and as a bonus feature, he created half-hour documentaries of all the famous individuals that young Indy met on his adventures. And Will Thomas is one of those characters, and T. Lawrence was another. So that's available on Amazon now. It's kind of pricey, but it was a fun outcome of the website as well. The Imperial War Museum borrowed dozens of items from the Will Thomas collection for a six-month-long exhibit they did on T. Lawrence, and they did a beautiful companion book with that as well, which highlighted a lot of the posters and artifacts in the collection. And it was fun working with the curators. They came over to look at the stuff, and they were absolutely thrilled that we had Will Thomas's original sun helmet that I think to them made their whole trip over worthwhile. So the type of use that the collections have received, particularly the Will Thomas collection, has been very satisfying. The users represent a wide range of backgrounds and interests, which is reflected in the depth of the Will Thomas collection, particularly. So thank you, and now I think we have plenty of time for questions if anybody has any.
I think it's an overview of a lot of things that we do have at the Special Collections. Charles is asking, what kind of information do we have on the Facebook? Is it particular to a certain collection, you're wondering, or if it's a little bit of everything? No, I don't think so. Right now, this is the one that we have up there is basically kind of a snapshot of everything that we kind of have, and people can post their comments. But that's a wonderful idea. That's something we would definitely explore. It could be a nice offshoot of the Facebook page that we have up right now. Thank you.
So, I guess over to the side first. Well, at Marist, we're relying on a variety of things, whether it's on-campus publications. Press releases have been successful for us, so we try to get in the New York Times when we can, or regional papers. Occasionally, we can get a brief spot on local television, or rarely on a larger network. But we basically do all of these things, including doing announcements on the listservs as well. And it's that combination that really seems to be what we have to do to draw in as large an audience as possible. So, and it also sometimes we, through serendipity, we stumble across something else, a society or and another individual that will help give us some ideas and other ways to approach it. But I don't know if Lynn or Tom would like to respond to that as well.
In terms of advertising Flickr, we have links on the web pages themselves. So like for the center web pages, if there's a Flickr site, then there's a link to that. And so what we're trying to do is to put those links in various places so people can find it however they're coming into our repository.
For UNLV Special Collections, right now we do a lot of in-house advertising. We have things posted in our front desk. On our updated UNLV Libraries website, though, we have more of a prominent position now. We have kind of a rotating slideshow of the different types of resources that UNLV Library has, but Special Collections is one of those main pictures. We really wanted to be on the forefront rather than people having to kind of dig deep down and drill down the UNLV Libraries website to find us. And one of the things we promote a lot of is our digital collections, specifically like the Boomtown years. In terms of like cross promotion beyond that, we'd certainly explore that. I think that'd be a wonderful idea. Working with like regional archival associations like SEMA, we definitely would like to do something like that.
I think there's another question on the right. Yes.
Well, with the recent comments, I know that our director of Special Collections receives the comments that we have on the digital collections, and he can review them and even answer some of their questions. In terms of vetting, I don't think we really have. We want to watch whatever that goes onto the website, of course, but we try to make it as accessible as possible without, with some an understanding that we need to have some sort of vetting. But we try to, our goal really is to answer whatever questions that they have. It's almost like a reference source for us, and those questions go right to our director, and then he goes from there with it.
I'll respond first, if you don't mind. Since I'm from a very small shop, when I said we, a lot of times it was me. So with the audio documentary on the environmental history, I did almost all the interviews. Actually, for that, I did all the interviews, and I actually edited the audio documentary myself using Audacity, which is a free freeware, so you can download that. It's very useful if anybody hasn't used it before. I love to take advantage of or double dip, I guess, if I can. So I was taking a graduate history course and making audio documentaries. So this was an outcome of that class. I had the professor at my disposal to help me with it, to getting through the process. And he's been a great contact for regional NPR stations too. The travelogue video I created with a graduate student, so there's just two of us doing most of that, and our media center helped out with putting all the components together, including the voiceover, because we had to hire a local actor to do that, because we unfortunately don't have the audio of Thomas doing that documentary. So I don't know if there's...
I think in general, prioritizing, everybody has to prioritize as to what we're going to, what collections we're going to focus on and how we can do it. And we have stayed away from digitizing videos. I mean, that was digitizing commercials. We had to wait for somebody to give us money because we couldn't afford to do that. And so that has always been on the radar, but so far under the radar because we couldn't deal with it. So that was just something serendipitously put into our lap that we were able to deal with. And we had a local vendor who was always the one, whenever we had somebody who wanted to have something transferred to digital video, then we would always go through that person. So he was already in our knowledge base and we could already trust him to work on that. So I think prioritizing, it's everybody has to deal with it.
At UNLV Special Collections, like for example, like the Dino at the Sands, without a doubt, that's one of our highest hit pages on our website. People want to see photographs of Dino. We did prioritize based on usage and requests. In terms of, say, the digital collections, without a doubt, we started a lot of the digital collections. A lot of that information came out of our special collections. Even though it's a UNLV Libraries initiative, you know, we really got it off the ground. And we continue to provide historical material to the newer ones. They have a team, a digital content team, that is now going to other departments on campus and asking them, what would you like to give us that we could scan and put into a digital collection, you know, within our content DM databases. And we even go to other libraries, like our architectural studies library. In terms of really getting a lot of the information, they still come to us. And people really are more fascinated with a lot of the historical materials. So we kind of prioritize that way. But without a doubt, Special Collections drives a lot of our content DM databases.
Yes, in the second row.
The question was about pushback and using new technologies. We waited a long time to get into videos, and we're having to wait for the digital group to allow us to have the blog. We have to wait for them to get up to a point where they feel comfortable about having the blog and have the right technology to do that. The pushback that we've received has been more from users. People are frustrated with iTunes, and searching iTunes and using it, and they're ready for us to put it into into YouTube or some other format. We've gotten, I mean, I'm surprised at how many comments have come in as to, this is a great site, but y'all need to move it as soon as possible. We've been really lucky that our library has wanted to go to the next step as soon as possible, because I think we feel that we've waited a while to be involved at that level. So they're pushing us. There's a particular person in the systems group who's, it's sort of his initiative to, and he's pushed a lot of this himself, and the library has accepted what he's done within, you know, framework that they've set up. But we've had the leadership help pull us into that next level.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your coming to hear our talk.